You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Forget the frustration of picking commerce platforms when you switch your business to Shopify, the global commerce platform that supercharges your selling wherever you sell. With Shopify, you'll harness the same intuitive features, trusted apps, and powerful analytics used by the world's leading brands. Sign up today for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/tech, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/tech.
Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America N.A., member FDIC.
This is Kick-Ass News. I'm Ben Mathis. Support for today's show comes from Google Play. Did you know that you can now download and listen to audiobooks on Google Play? That's right. With hands-free listening using Google Assistant or Chromecast, you can enjoy thousands of titles a la carte, no subscription necessary. There's even multi-device integration across the Google ecosystem. And for a limited time, you get $10 off your first one by visiting g.co/play/kick. That's g.co/play/kick. Find your story with audiobooks on Google Play. And now, enjoy the show.
Walking around, I got no one to talk to. There's everyone, and then there's just me. If I could change, don't you think that I'd do it? God only knows why he cursed me to be a straight white man. I state my problems, other people roll their eyes. 3 trips to the mall, 0 khakis in my slide. I've never been the victim of a random search for drugs. But you can't say my life is easy until you've walked a mile in my Uggs. Straight white man, I know the road looks tough ahead. The women want rights, the gays want kids. What? Can't you just leave us alone and also no to the things you asked for? They're being greedy and they know it, okay?
That was a song from comedian Bo Burnham's 2013 Netflix special. Bo Burnham first gained notoriety in 2006 at the age of 16 when he posted 2 parody songs on YouTube that went viral virtually overnight. Since then, his videos have been viewed over 228 million times, and he's become one of the most popular young comedians working today, having starred in 3 hour-long live comedy specials by the time he was 25. In his music and stand-up performances, he both satirizes and sympathizes with the existential woes of his generation, commenting on race, gender, religion, sexuality, social media, and pop culture. Now he brings that same biting humor and piercing insight to a new movie that takes an honest and empathetic look at adolescence. 8th Grade is Bo Burnham's debut film as a writer and director. It premiered at the Sundance Film Festival, where it was nominated for the Grand Jury Prize and walked away with the Audience Favorite Award. 8th Grade just opened in theaters nationwide to rave reviews from critics, and today Bo joins me on the podcast to talk about some of the autobiographical elements of his movie, why he went to great lengths to avoid nostalgia in his portrayal of middle school, and how casting a real 13-year-old girl kept him honest. He shares how he drew inspiration from watching hours of web videos made by preteens, how much the internet has changed since he made his own YouTube debut in 2006, and why he doesn't pass judgment on millennials' addiction to social media. He discusses the challenges of being a first-time director, why he only allowed his lead actress to read the script for eighth grade one time, and how this comedian known for very big humor learned to appreciate the small moments. Plus, a few words of wisdom for kids going through those awkward years, coming up with Bo Burnham in just a moment. Bo Burnham is a popular comedian and songwriter with 3-hour-long live comedy specials under his belt. He's also directed specials for Jared Carmichael and Chris Rock, and now he's written and directed his first feature film called Eighth Grade. It premiered to raves at the Sundance Film Festival this year, and it's now out in theaters. Bo Burnham, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks
and congratulations.
Appreciate it. Thank you.
You know, I really enjoyed this movie, and I went into it not thinking that I was going to, because I'm not usually a big fan of teen movies. You know, they tend to always be really kind of dumb humor, or on the flip side, they're always too schmaltzy and sentimental, overly dramatic, you know, for the actual events taking place.
Right, right.
This film has the ring of truth to it.
No, that's nice. Well, I appreciate it.
You know, of all the places that you could have gone with this, why did you land on the eighth grade?
I had been interested in, I was wondering why there weren't more middle school movies for a while. Mm-hmm. You know, I think there's a lot of high school movies, understandably, because I think we like to look back on high school. It's a time that we are excited by. And I think middle school is the time we try to forget, specifically eighth grade, sort of try to bury. So I wanted to make a movie that was not nostalgic, was not a memory, but was visceral and felt, and tried to tackle that time as it feels to kids now, which hopefully, you know, feels universal and hopefully you feel nostalgic as you watch it. But the intent was not to, you know, revisit my past. It was more to try to engage with this kid's present.
Yeah, and I think the thing that I love the most about Eighth Grade, the movie, not the experience, is that it kind of does say everything that anyone with a few years of hindsight would want to tell an adolescent about that period in their life, that all of these things that seem so important really are nothing, and your life is going to have so many more chapters, so many fresh starts. Nothing is really the end of the world, even though it seems like it at that age.
Right, but the feelings they feel are real and important, and you know, the sort of things you start to wrestle with at that age are going to be things that you're going to wrestle with for the rest of your life. You know, little simple things she talks about, like being yourself and how to be confident. It sounds very corny, but the truth is, like, I don't know how to be myself still. Do I know how to be confident? Like, those are those are deep questions, and I think you do start to wrestle with those things very, very early.
Yeah, it's not something that you ever really get over. You just learn to accept it as part of life.
There's a great quote that's like, maturity is a phase, adolescence is forever. And I think that's kind of true.
Yeah, and you have such a great message for young people, but it's also a very smart, mature film for adults that's done incredibly well on the festival circuit. Who is the audience for this movie?
You know, I just wanted to make a movie that I wanted to see, you know, and I'm a childless 27-year-old man. So, you know, I hope parents can see themselves in the film. I hope kids can see themselves. But I also hope people that, you know, might not directly demographically align with either see themselves expressed in it. I am most personally invested. I have been most personally changed and affected by movies that I don't demographically align with, you know, and that's a very powerful thing in art, and especially movies, is that to see yourself and to see feelings you recognize in someone that might not be like you. So, you know, it's not like Hamlet is only for princes of Denmark. It's not like Apollo 13 is only for astronauts, you know. So a movie about eighth grade, I think, can be for everybody too, I hope.
Well, when you were this age, were you the kind of kid who people might describe as a 30-year-old in a 13-year-old's body?
No, I was a hammy loser.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I was like, I was a hammy little 13-year-old boy that was just like eating dirt and like kicking things. I mean, I was not, it wasn't until 15 or 16 that I kind of became my, you know, self-aware at all. I think it probably starts on average for girls a little bit earlier. But yeah, I see myself in her much more now than I did then. You know, I have much more in common with the character now.
Fans of yours will see some parallels to your own life because the main character, Kayla, makes YouTube videos with dreams of being an internet celebrity. You, of course, got your break, I think, in high school when you were recording comedic songs on YouTube that went viral. How much of this film is autobiographical?
Well, you know, it's funny. It's like her relationship with the internet is much more autobiographical with my relationship with the internet now. I mean, yes, I was trying to express myself at that time, but the internet didn't ask as deep a questions of you in 2006 when I was starting. It was like, you got a funny song? Post it online. You got a funny skit? Post it. And now the internet's really asking you to reflect yourself. You know, a big shift has happened in the last 10 years.
Yeah.
And you know, it's much more... For example, when I was young, it was MySpace. You got a photo and some of your interests, list them. And now it's Twitter and Instagram. What do you look like? What do you think? What do you look like? What do you think? Those are base, weird questions. So the sort of like, the sort of mind, you know, the sort of messing with her head that she's dealing with is much more on par with what I deal with now. I don't think the internet reached that deep into us in 2006.
Yeah, I don't think that there was that belligerence where the fans and the internet think that they're somehow entitled to a piece of your soul and they want to know every intimate detail. When you're on vacation, they want to see photos and everything.
Yeah, it's very strange. It's a strange thing, especially for kids to have to engage with, to not only have to maintain your life in the real world, but maintain your life online. It's there's enough on your plate when you're that age. Your body is exploding and your mind is mush.
And it's interesting how it's changed since you first started out with these YouTube videos, because I think when you started out, it seemed like the internet was sort of a means to an end.
People who did
things on the on social media or on YouTube were trying to get a TV deal, trying to get attention for that. Now it has become the end.
Yes,
where just being an internet celebrity is its own thing. And sometimes
it's even the reverse. It's like people go on TV shows so they can get more Twitter followers. You know, it's kind of the opposite. But and that's part of it, is to say that, and I believe that the internet is a valid form of expression and a valid form of representation. It's not like, okay, now that I'm portraying the internet in a movie, it's finally real. You know, it's not that. It's just I'm trying to bring it into this other medium and also respect the internet. You know, this isn't trying to be a takedown of it. This isn't trying to be a TED talk about the dangers of the internet. I'm just trying to be an emotional description of it, which is it's great and it's bad. If it was just bad, it'd be so much easier to address. Problem is, it connects us and it isolates us. It stimulates us and it numbs us. It does all these things. And we just need to, I think, talk about it in a more subtle way than Russia or however we're talking about the internet nowadays.
Yeah, because the media does portray it as Facebook, Instagram, Snapchat. All of this is just acerbating the worst aspects of being a teen, the bullying, the clicks, obsession with trends. This film really doesn't seem to make any particular judgment on the internet. So you think the impact that it has on young people may not be as bad as we adults want to think these days?
Well, it's a lot of things. It may be that as well. It's a place for them to connect with each other and for lonely kids that would be completely isolated to find, a shared experience. To give a voice to a group of people, you know, that may never have gotten a voice because of it, and sort of democratized a form of expression that's probably good. Mm-hmm. My thing is that, like, the finger wagging about the internet to me is just seems like it's coming from people that don't understand it, that haven't engaged with it. I have engaged with it. The internet means something to me. I grew up with a form of it. So I was really just trying to do myself justice as much as the kids, you know, like, I felt like the internet wasn't being represented in a way that in media that reflected my experience. Mm-hmm. And that's sort of what I wanted to do.
I think that this film also comes about just at the right time when adults are starting to actually reconsider all the finger wagging and take young people this age more seriously.
Absolutely.
Like the Parkland students, and starting to acknowledge that maybe teens have more than just a mere cultural impact on society.
Yeah. And that they have a real perspective on their experience that is unique and valid and probably more valid. And maybe the internet has not just dumbed them down, but it's also made them like hyper aware and sort of intelligent in a very different way.
Yeah.
I think they're very socially intelligent and very, very self-aware in a way that can be destructive, but also very deep and powerful.
Well, now that you're an old fogey, how did you go about actually tapping into the teen zeitgeist? Did you have to do some research into what's popular with kids that age now?
Yeah, no. Well, it's really like if you want to learn anything about these kids, they're posting everything about themselves online, so it's pretty easy to find anything out.
Yeah.
And also, you know, I wasn't writing a novel. I was making a movie, so I knew that, like, I was not the only author of this thing. I wanted real kids of that age to be part of the movie and to be able to express themselves and author their own moments. So, yeah, that was really what it was. It was just letting go of the control more than, you know, trying to have this incredibly specific vision that all the kids need to bend to.
I read that you also searched eighth grade vlogs online and looked for kids, I guess, with the least amount of views on YouTube or
wherever.
Yeah,
sort of by upload date, and you get the most recently uploaded videos, which are kids, you know, with 12 subscribers.
What did you learn from doing that?
That, you know, that was the sort of the inspiration for the script, seeing these kids talk about their lives and seeing how complex their quote-unquote performance was of themselves. And thinking, man, if this were a performance in a movie, it would be absolutely incredible.
Mm-hmm.
The boys tended to talk about Fortnite, and the girls talked about their souls. So it was like, well, okay, probably going to be about a girl. but yeah, I just found the internet can sometimes, as it's represented, because the sort of stuff that's rewarded on it and the stuff that kind of goes viral tends to be very glossy and very apparently fake. But if you dig just a little below the surface, the internet can be a real well of just raw, raw humanity in a way that no other popular medium is able to do, to get access to someone so unfiltered, so unprocessed. It's really exciting.
Did you think that, I guess, girls were better conduits for adolescent angst or that they had more introspection?
I think probably in a way. I think they tend to, maybe actively introspect or actively express that in a way that just registers cinematically a little better. And also, it did insulate me from projecting my own experience onto it. You know, I then couldn't make a nostalgic movie, which I didn't want to do. I didn't want to talk about my eighth grade experience.
Okay.
And it being a girl sort of forced me to have to humble myself before whatever her truth was.
Yeah, I mean, what is it? It's got to be like 13 or 14 years since you were in the eighth grade yourself.
Yeah.
You know, when directors make movies about that period, with all that hindsight, they do tend to be overly sentimental. How else did you manage to avoid the nostalgia trap and manage to portray adolescence in such an authentic way?
I just tried to think of it like I was World War II. Like, it was like I was making a World War II movie with veterans. You know what I mean? Like, and it was like, I didn't go through this, because the disconnect from me, from her, that I have is twofold. I was never a 13-year-old girl, and I was never a 13-year-old now. And both of those lend themselves to a very specific experience that I wanted to serve. So, I was just trying to listen. Just listen to the kids. You know, let them lead.
Yeah.
And just try to be honest.
Did you ever have to catch yourself when you were maybe writing too much like an adult?
No, well, because I had the dad character to be and the teachers to be out of touch, because I was also trying to give voice to the out of touch idiots like me that don't know things. So that was nice. The adults in the movie are out of touch that don't know what's going on. So it was good to have them to be able to voice all of my stupid questions I had that I probably knew the answers to.
Yeah, I think one of the best and most heartfelt moments in this film is between the main character, Kayla, and her dad. I mean, God, how I felt for that poor guy. I mean, we are such assholes to our parents when we're age, aren't we?
That's the job of the parent, though. That, like, kind of the job as a parent is to be a punching bag a little bit. They've got so much shit going on. It's like, let them get it out on you. They can't get it out in school. They can't get it out on their teachers. Sometimes the only people we can be cruel to are the people we love and are comfortable enough to be cruel to. So part of it's like, that's the job. That's part of the job description, is to take it. They've got a lot going on the inside.
And the main character of Kayla, she talks about wanting to make this big leap from being an introvert. In fact, she gets voted, I think, the class
most quiet.
And she wants to come out of her shell and eventually sort of begins to force herself out of that. Is that what music and comedy were for you? Were they a way for you to come out of your shell? Or were you...
I didn't get into my shell until sort of late in life. You know,
oh, really?
It's funny. Yeah, I was more out of my shell when I was younger.
Okay.
And that's, again, why it was like I was really just trying to make a movie about how I was feeling at the time I wrote it. But yeah, no, in a way, yes, I was terrified as a kid, terrified of authority, terrified of being in trouble, anxious all the time. And yeah, I think so. Well, certainly music, comedy, theater, all that stuff is a way for me to engage with the world and express myself. And it's very important for kids to do, not just career-wise. It's important for kids to know they can express themselves and be confident, and they can just pretend to be confident, and it's just as good as being confident.
Who were some of your comedic inspirations growing up, or musical inspirations as well? Like Weird Al, Steve Martin,
70s Steve
Martin. I can see that in your act, yeah.
Yeah, okay. I love Weird Al. George Carlin and, yeah, Chappelle.
How about musically?
I mean, not inspired. I mean, I just love Chappelle. I wouldn't say I was inspired by him. I'm not good enough to be inspired by him.
But also musically, is there a lot of musical theater in
I
your background? Jonathan Larson,
up.
Maybe?
Yeah. Some, you know, Tom Lehrer in mm-hmm. that space. Yeah, I loved Sondheim.
Oh, okay. Yeah. How about when you started making this movie, any particular directors that you looked up to?
In this space, like, Catherine Breillat's Amasur was pretty big, and Marissa Silver made a film called Old Enough that was wonderful, and Woman Under the Influence, and so yeah, Cassavetes for sure, and even like The Wrestler. The initial idea was like, can I make The Wrestler with a 13-year-old girl just in an average day? What else? Kreisha, this film by Trey Edward Schultz, a recent one that I really loved. Raw. It was a very, very recent one. Julia de Cornos film I saw right before production started, and I loved it.
Excellent.
And thought like, oh, she's doing exactly what I'd want to try to do, which is balance sort of – the way she does set pieces is just very, very effective and incredible. One Flew of the Cuckoo's Nest.
Oh, yeah.
It's a good one. Like the chaos of the actors in that, the controlled chaos of the acting is just so beautiful and raw and natural and structured. I wanted the middle school to feel like One Flew of the Cuckoo's Nest.
We're going to take a quick break, and then I'll be back with more with Bo Burnham when we come back in just a minute. Hey, guys, I want to tell you about Dollar Shave Club. Dollar Shave Club delivers everything you need to look, feel, and smell your best. You name it. Shampoo, conditioner, body wash, toothpaste, hair gel, even body wipes. Dollar Shave Club is my one-stop go-to for all of my toiletries, and I've especially become a huge fan of their Amber and Lavender Calming Body Cleanser. It smells absolutely fantastic, and it's a great way to get your day going. But all of Dollar Shave Club's products are great and made with top-shelf ingredients that won't break your budget. Plus, shipping is free with your membership. And here's a great way to try a bunch of Dollar Shave Club's products. For just $5, you can get their Daily Essentials Starter Set. It comes with body cleanser, One Wipe Charlie's, their amazing wipes, their world-famous shave butter, and their best razor, the Six-Blade Executive. Keep the blades coming for a few more bucks a month and add in shampoo, toothpaste, or anything else you need. Check it out at dollarshaveclub.com/kickass. That's dollarshaveclub.com/kickass. Did you spend your night tossing and turning? If so, I feel your pain. Literally. Chronic back and neck pain have led to many a sleepless night for me. And even worse is that feeling when you wake up all stiff and achy. That's no way to start your day. I talk a lot on this podcast about the importance of getting a full night's sleep. It's vital to your physical, mental, and emotional health, and even your overall longevity. That's why I want you to know about Purple Mattress. Made with brand new material that was developed by an actual rocket scientist, the Purple Mattress will feel different than anything you've ever experienced. Unlike traditional memory foam, the Purple Mattress is both firm and soft, so it's supportive yet comfortable. Plus, it's breathable, so it sleeps cool. That's a big one for me. And with their 100-night risk-free trial, if you're not fully satisfied, you can return your mattress for a full refund. Not to mention, it's backed by a 10-year warranty with free shipping and returns. Folks, you're going to love Purple. And right now, our listeners will get 10% off your entire order in addition to this week's free gift with the purchase of a mattress. Just go to purple.com and use my promo code KICK at checkout. That's purple.com, code KICK. The only way to get 10% off plus your free gift if you use code KICK at checkout. One more time, that's purple.com, code KICK. How do you stay up to date with the latest business news? If you're still relying on traditional news outlets, keeping up with the news feels like a chore, but it doesn't have to be that way. Business news can be enjoyable, even something you actually look forward to. How? It's called Morning Brew, and it's a free daily email newsletter that delivers the latest business news directly to your inbox every weekday morning. The writers at Morning Brew curate the top business stories that you should know about and deliver them in a conversational and witty tone. Best of all, it's just a quick 5-minute read. Seriously, imagine getting all the information you need to start your day in just 5 minutes and enjoying every second of it. I know how overwhelming it can be when you've got so much news coming at you every day, and that's why I subscribe to Morning Brew for my business news. I love that it's concise, easy to read, and even entertaining, a great, fast way to get the most essential business news before I head into the office. So what are you waiting for? Sign up for free at morningbrew.com/kick. That's morningbrew.com/kick to start getting your daily dose of business news. And now, back to the show. On some level, you must sort of envy young people today because, you know, probably for you, when you were starting out making YouTube videos and all that, you probably had all of these inspirations that you would have loved to reach out to. And now young people can, like, hit up Steve Martin or someone on Twitter and actually get their attention.
Yeah, but no one will ever write back to them, you know. And I feel bad because, like, I think it's very, very hard to break through as a young person on the internet.
But sometimes they do write back.
Yeah, do they?
Maybe you don't.
Okay, I don't know. Steve Martin doesn't. A lot of people. Yeah. I mean, and
Well, and I know that you've worked with Judd Apatow before. Has he ever told you his Steve Martin story about when he was a little kid?
We wrote him a letter. What was it?
Yeah. He wanted to get an autograph. He was riding with his mom or his aunt in Hollywood or in Beverly Hills, doing a star tours. And then Steve Martin was coming out to get his newspaper, so he came, rushed up to him, and asked for an autograph. Steve declined, and then Judd writes this long screed to him as like a little teenage boy, you know, we're your fans. You wouldn't be in that fancy house if it weren't for us and all that. And then Steve Martin writes back and sends him a book saying, oh, I'm so sorry. I didn't realize I was talking to the Judd Apatow.
Oh, yeah. Amazing.
Kid. You cast this wonderful girl who I've never seen in anything before named Elsie Fisher. She's just terrific as the lead in this film.
Yeah.
When you cast her for this part, what appealed to you about her?
She was the only one, and we auditioned a lot of kids, and every kid felt like a confident kid pretending to be shy, and she played it like a shy kid pretending to be confident, which is what the role is, you know? She didn't play Kayla. She played Kayla. She played all the people Kayla wanted to be in every moment, because it is a performance within a performance, you know? It's someone trying to be something she's not all the time. And she made the character very active, because on paper it could be a very passive, blank character, and I think she imbued her with a lot of wants and desire and drive.
Yeah, I haven't seen her anything before. Was this her first big movie?
Yeah, she was the voice of Agnes in Despicable Me, of the youngest girl that did It's So Fluffy. That's her.
Okay.
And then she was in a few small parts in a few little movies, but this is her first lead.
Yeah, and just a total side note here, but I just want to say thank you for ditching all the fake screens that we see in movies.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a big issue for me. Yeah, that was a huge issue.
Yeah, I mean, it can't have been easy, but no, I guess I should explain. When I say fake screens, usually when people watch the movies, it's digitally put in there, the screen on an iPhone or a television set and so forth. You actually just took the camera and filmed the actual device or the TV.
Yeah, and people told me, like, don't worry, the screen replacements are great now. And I'm like, no, they aren't. Yeah. I feel like I can always tell and they look bad, especially a bright screen in the dark that's being reflected on someone's face. Because the thing is even if the screen replacement looks good, the ambient light coming off of the screen when you're scrolling changes on their face and their thumb, and you have to see that organically. So me and my DP, Andrew Wade, did a lot of testing way before we even were greenlit, before we had any money. We were just testing to make sure we could film these screens, and we had to do all of the internet practically. It's really Instagram. We had to make 500 fake accounts and all this. It was an absolute nightmare.
Wow. So there's actually someone texting her,
DMing
off
her
screen.
Yep. Yeah. Really? All that stuff. Great. So that was an absolute nightmare for our props department and our production designer. But it was worth it for me in the end.
And it's interesting to contrast what you do in this movie to your comedy act, because on stage, you know, you mentioned that you were a fan of Steve Martin. Like Steve Martin, you go very big on stage, whereas this is way subtler. The themes are very familiar, but I would say that it has a very different tone.
Oh, definitely.
As a comedian turned writer-director, was it hard for you to rein in that impulse to always go for the joke and to maybe put the story first?
No, it was really the opposite, where it was like, I was just so tired of that. You know what I mean? I was so tired of doing all that. But yeah, you're exactly right. Like my stage show, very written, trying to be clever, satirical, cynical, ironic, mm-hmm. all that stuff. And I was just so tired of that stuff. And I was even on stage going, I'm just so desperate to do something like softer and quieter and not necessarily yeah. having, because it's such a pressure on stage to have to get a laugh every 20 seconds, you know?
Yeah.
And so it was really freeing to be able to get away from that and just like, this felt like a more honest version of what I am. Mm-hmm. I'm not running around all day cracking jokes. You know what I mean? So like, it felt way more pressure to have to. My natural yeah. impulse, I think, is something more like this movie and less like my stage act.
Really? Yeah. And I think it serves the story really well as well, because I think we were just saying with a lot of these teen movies, they tend to over-dramatize things. They tend to make every little misstep, every little argument into, you know, the end of the world, something so dramatic. Whereas this film seems to kind of revel in the small moments.
And yeah, they feel like the end of the world to her, yeah. but they aren't actually. That's sort of the thing, is that like, because life feels so intense to mm-hmm. kids that age, they make movies that are that intense yeah, in structure. Exactly. But we wanted to make something that was like, can we make a movie feel as intense as it yeah. feels to her, but it's actually just a regular day in her life. You know, it's not like when she walks out to the pool party, everyone's pointing and laughing at her. You know, it's not like she's got a milkshake poured on her head. You know, those things don't need to yeah. happen for it
yeah,
to be significant.
Yeah, there's no Carrie moment in this film.
Yeah, she's not really severely bullied, or you know, mm-hmm. there's some rough moments in there, but we wanted to represent how life is, which I think in life, just for everybody, way less in the movies. I think people are so non-confrontational. I think people are so terrified of conflict in real life.
Yeah.
People do not yell at each other very often. People are scared to and bury confrontations. And the sort of stress of our lives is more low-level accumulated than it is pyrotechnic.
Yeah. You know? In service to that, a lot of the dialogue, I have to say, comes off very naturally. Did you leave a lot of room for improv?
To the actor's credit, really, no. I mean, the monologues were written, wow. yeah. So the thing about being yourself is I'm reading this off a piece of paper. You know, it wasn't that she had to be word yeah. perfect. I'm not going, you missed an here. Mm-hmm. But the scripts were written to be inarticulate. So there was a certain amount of freedom, I guess, moment to moment to, you know. Yeah. But it is written. It is, okay. It is, and that's, I'm saying that for the credit of Elsie. Like, it yeah. wasn't like, just be yourself and I'll figure this out. She's giving a very technical, reliable performance. Mm-hmm. And I can show you multiple takes of her stumbling in the same spot every time. Like, this wasn't just a documentary. She's giving a very, very technical performance.
Wow. Now, I heard that you only let Elsie read the script, I think, once before you went into it.
Yeah.
I've always heard that Woody Allen does something similar to that, in that I guess he only gives people the pages right before they shoot, or the morning of the
yeah,
shoot.
Yeah, we did that as well. She got her pages the morning of.
Do you think that gives you a more natural performance than when you let an actor exhaust every possible read of a line before they go
yeah,
before the camera?
Yeah, it should be fresh in your mind,
yeah.
I think. I just don't think sitting with things and overbaking them works mm-hmm. too well. I mean, it can for some actors. There are wonderful theater actors that can do that, but it's also actor by actor, but also really a project by project thing. For this, mm-hmm. we want it to feel very, very spontaneous and new, and like these thoughts are occurring in real time. So it had to be very fresh. She also has a very photographic memory, so she can read something like a monologue once and have it memorized word perfect.
Really?
So it was best. I just didn't want her in her own head before yeah. the shoot, overthinking the scenes. Just throw ourselves into them and see what happens.
Yeah, yeah. She's just terrific in it. Were there any funny behind-the-scenes moments? Did you guys laugh off camera a lot?
Oh, yeah. She was laughing all the time. People think yeah. she was so stressed out because she looked so stressed out in the movie, but even in the pool party, she was, you know, laughing
yeah.
and screwing around the whole time. And the Gucci, her little sign-off, is hers. I mean, that's something she
oh,
would
yeah.
say on set all
oh,
the time.
Really?
And I would say back to her to make fun of her or just to embarrass her. And then eventually we filmed the videos at the very, very end of the shoot. And I was like, she needs yeah. a sign off. And so I let it be hers. So she literally has the last word of the movie. That is her. I don't even
okay.
get it. I don't even know what it means.
Are you a very funny director as a comedian come director? What is it like behind the scenes on set?
I don't know.
Set?
I hope
do
I'm an
actor's
director.
Jokes?
No, yeah. not really. No, I hope I'm just – well, yeah, sure. I'll keep it light and fun. But
yeah.
like my – I hope I just – the actors feel like they are – being seen and attended to, and mm-hmm. I'm in it with them. I really do feel like I'm in it with the actors, you know? I kind of feel like I need to act in order to direct.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I need to act with them.
Have you thought about what you might direct next?
I'm not a great multitasker, so no. Once this is over, I'll just bang my head against the wall and try to think of something else. But I'd love to do another movie if the idea is right.
Yeah. Would you go back to this particular chapter, the teen years?
Fifth grade would be great, like Lord of the Flies.
Oh, yeah.
Like true chaos.
Yeah.
Or do like an Apu trilogy and keep checking in with Kayla. I'd be up for whatever.
How about a musical?
Yeah, I'd love to do a musical. I'd probably love to do a musical for the stage, though.
Okay.
More than the screen, I think.
Yeah. I mean, that would be fantastic.
Yeah, that'd
I would
be very
love
fun.
To
That's
see
a
that.
Very, very long process, though. That's like an eight-year process, but I'd love to dig into that at some point.
Well, weren't you at some point working on a movie musical, I think?
Yeah, with Judd.
Yeah,
with Judd Apatow, yeah. It was like an R-rated high school musical, and it was I was 18, so I was not prepared to do it, but it was a very great process. I, you know, learned a lot from Judd during that.
Yeah, you think you might revisit it at some point?
Probably not. Okay. I don't think I could ever read that script that I wrote when I was 18, but I'm happy I did it. And I'm happy it wasn't made.
Yeah. At the top, I mentioned that this film kind of says everything that you want a kid at that age to know. I wonder, do you worry that because it is such a smart film that, you know, went the festival route and received all this critical praise, that it might not reach the young people who sort of most need to hear that particular message?
You know, I've sort of my whole, you know, tiny career has been built off of thinking kids are smarter than you think they are, you know, and they've always surprised me. So, and I don't think this thing's too smart or anything. I think, I think it's just trying to be honest, and I think they can take honesty and, you know, and I think it's for people 3 years out of eighth grade too. So, or four or 10 or 20. So like if in a couple years they look back on this time, that'll be nice. So, and we've had eighth graders that connect with it. You know, we've seen a lot of eighth graders at that screening. So,
oh, no kidding.
Yeah, it's for, you know, I think it's for a certain probably type of kid that's maybe open to it. But, yeah, no judgment.
Yeah. Now, before we go, what would you want teens and also the parents of teens or adolescents to take away from the movie, aside from a good time?
Well, I hope the teens – I hope that parents leave empathizing for their kids a little more. I hope that – kids leave empathizing for their parents a little more. That'd be nice. And maybe inspire a conversation. We just want to give the tools to maybe have a conversation. We just want to make you feel something. We don't really need you to take away anything specific. We're just trying to inspire feelings.
Well, it's just a fantastic film, and I encourage everyone to see it. Once more, it's called Eighth Grade. It's in theaters now. Bo Burnham, congratulations, and thanks for talking with me.
Appreciate the time. Thank you.
Thanks again to Bo Burnham for coming on the podcast. Eighth Grade is now playing in theaters nationwide. For more information and showtimes, visit eighthgrade.movie. Also, check him out at BoBurnham.com and follow him on Twitter at BoBurnham. Hey guys, I'm such a big fan of Dollar Shave Club, and I'm so happy to have them as a sponsor on the show. Dollar Shave Club delivers everything you need to look, feel, and smell your best. You name it, shampoo, conditioner, body wash, toothpaste, even wipes to keep you feeling clean. And here's a great way to try a bunch of Dollar Shave Club's products. For just $5, you can get their Daily Essentials Starter Set. It comes with Body Cleanser, One Wipe Charlie's, their world-famous shave butter, and their best razor, the Six Blade Executive. Keep the blades coming for a few more bucks a month and add in shampoo, toothpaste, and anything else you need. So show your support for the show and check it all out at dollarshaveclub.com/kickass. That's dollarshaveclub.com/kickass. Support for today's show comes from Google Play. Did you know that you can now download and listen to audiobooks on Google Play? That's right, with hands-free listening using Google Assistant or Chromecast, you can enjoy thousands of titles a la carte, no subscription necessary. There's even multi-device integration across the Google ecosystem. And for a limited time, you get $10 off your first one by visiting g.co/play/kick. That's g.co/play/kick. Find your story with audiobooks on Google Play. If you haven't already, be sure to subscribe to Kick-Ass News on iTunes and leave us a review. You can follow us on Facebook or on Twitter at Kick-Ass News Pod. And as always, I welcome your comments, questions, and ideas at comments@kickassnews.com. I'm Ben Mathis, and thanks for listening to Kick-Ass News.
Kick-Ass News is a trademark of Mathis Entertainment, Inc.